Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 12, The Birth of Emperor Bhrigud, text number 5. News even reached the celestial planets about Maharaj Yudhisthira's worldly possessions, the sacrifices by which he would attain a better destination, his queen, his stalwart brothers, his extensive land, his sovereignty over the planet Earth, and his fame, etc. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Only a rich and great man's name and fame are known all over the world, and the name and fame of Maharaj Yudhisthira reached the higher planets because of his good administration, worldly possessions, glorious wife Draupadi, the strength of his brothers Bhima and Arjuna, and his solid sovereign power over the world, known as Jambadvipa. Here the word lokaha is significant. There are different lokas or higher planets scattered all over the sky, both material and spiritual. A person can reach them by dint of his work in the present life, as stated in the Bhagavad Gita 9:25. No forceful entrance is allowed there. The tiny material scientists and engineers who have discovered vehicles to travel only a few thousand miles in outer space will not be allowed entrance. This is not the way to reach the better planets. One must qualify himself to enter into such happy planets by sacrifice and service. Those who are sinful in every step of life can expect only to be degraded into animal life to suffer more and more the pains of material existence. And this is also stated in Bhagavad Gita 16:19. Maharaj Yudhisthira's good sacrifices and qualifications were so lofty and virtuous that even the residents of the higher celestial planets were already prepared to receive him as one of them. So, in this chapter, we're discussing the birth of Emperor Parikshit. So, in previous chapters, we've heard in some of the chapters, up to about 7, I think it is, we've heard how Krishna deals with his devotees. what are some examples of in those maybe first 7 or 8 chapters, Krishna dealing with different devotees? What are some of the examples of Krishna dealing with some of his devotees very nicely in the, you know, perhaps first 7 or 8 chapters in the Srimad Bhagavatam? Yeah. Is that in this section of the Bhagavatam? First 7 or 8 chapters? Is that mentioned here? That's in the Krishna book. What we've read so far. It's there, but it's not mentioned until later.
Krishna hears the
prayers
of Madhava.
Yes. Yeah. So he, of course, he saved Prakrit Maharaj. So that was going back to chapter 7, I think. He saved Prakrit Maharaj. Heard it was it chapter 7? Something there. Heard the prayers of Uttara and yes, saved Prakrit Maharaj. Yeah. Other examples? Yes. Yes, yes. So very, very nice hearing the prayers of Kunti and reciprocating with her. Yes. Any other? Yep. No, that goes on.
Yes.
That's right. He satisfied everyone in that incident with Ashwatthama. Yeah, that's right. There was a lot of opposing elements, and everyone ended up perfectly happy by the way that Krishna dealt with them. Any other examples? So yes, Krishna protected Arjuna as well. Other examples? Yep. Yes, yeah, very nice. There's Krishna entering Dwarka. Beautiful reciprocation there with his devotees. And other examples as well?
Maybe could you repeat the question from
Mahaprabhu? Oh, we're just going over some of the things we've already read, you know, in the Bhagavatam, up to chapter 12, where Krishna's dealing nicely with his devotees, and we can also include, you know, where the devotees are expressing their, you know, loving sentiments to Krishna. Vishvendra, yes. So who did you say? Yes. Yes. He went there so that Bhishma could Bhishma could see him at the time of death. That's right. Yeah. So a lot of the first canto up to this point, we do get a really nice taste of the nature of Krishna and that transcendental relationship, you know, with his devotees, and understanding. Also, we also get the understanding that, you know, there's a hint that those devotees who have that strong love and affection and meditating upon Krishna, ultimately they go back to Godhead. Back to the spiritual world, Krishna, of course, wanted to establish system, the Varnashram system within society, in such a way that everyone throughout the whole world had the opportunity to achieve the same benefits that his devotees are achieving, going back to Godhead. And therefore, in the course of this, we will also hear about the rule of Brigit Maharaj, the perfect arrangement, a combination of Krishna consciousness and Varnashram, in order to give everyone the opportunity to develop those same transcendental relationships that we've been hearing about and being, attracted to by the Srimad Bhagavatam. And in the fourth chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the sages of Naimisharanya, they also, so therefore we're talking about Parikrit Maharaj, and also back in the fourth chapter, they did specifically ask that Sudha Goswami would speak about Parikrit Maharaj's birth and activities. So again, we're returning to that topic for that reason as well, and as we explained the other day, that's in order to understand the glories of the Srimad Bhagavatam, as pointed out by Jiva Goswami in the Tattva Sandhava, there's an introduction of the various speakers and hearers of the Bhagavatam, Narada Muni, Śrīla Vyāsadeva, Sukadeva Goswami, and Parīkṣita Maharaj. And by understanding just how exalted these personalities are, then it gives us some faith in the Srimad Bhagavatam that, that yes, this is the topmost literature. How could it not be the topmost literature? Because the topmost persons within the universe who are glorious above everyone, they're absorbed in the Srimad Bhagavatam as, and they're saying that it's the cream. here, in order to introduce this topic of Parikrit Maharaj, it describes the situation at around about the time of Parikrit Maharaj's birth, that Yudhishthira administered generously to everyone during his reign. He was exactly like his father. He had no personal ambition and was free from all sorts of sense gratification because of his... might as well read the right verse. let's read that. We'll read it anyway. That's the previous verse, because this is how it introduces. Emperor Yudhishthira administered generously to everyone during his reign. He was exactly like his father. He had no personal ambition, was free from all sorts of sense gratification because of his continuous service under the lotus feet of Lord Sri Krishna. And today's verse, news even reached the celestial planets about Maharaj Yudhishthira's worldly possessions, the sacrifices by which he would attain a better destination, his queen, his stalwart brothers, his extensive land, his sovereignty over the planet Earth, and his fame, etc. And then, after a few verses discussing the background situation, we will actually hear again about the birth of Maharaj Parikrit, and then the qualities of that person who took birth, Maharaj Parikrit. So Yudhishthira Maharaj, we know that there was the battle of Kurukshetra, and a huge, predominantly most of the demoniac persons, and along with their huge military phalanxes, were all annihilated, removed. So it removed a huge burden of the world, for the world itself, and it also gave Maharaj Yudhishthira the opportunity to rule the world without rivals. Although, he had enemies. I mean, they became his enemy, he didn't become their enemy. But because they had no real strength, because the real strength of his enemies had been destroyed, he was able to rule. These days, of course, throughout the whole world, practically we don't see any rulers with any real power anymore. Everyone is constantly under threat, and if someone rules a country, then from within the country, just like we have a system, where every 3 years or so, what happens, someone gets elected, and then they have great difficulty in implementing anything they want to do, because they are constantly baffled by the other party. That is, the intelligence system we've set up. That imagine you elect a you have any sort of a head, and you say yes. What we'll do is we'll elect you as the head of this particular situation, and what we're going to do is that we're going to fight every decision you make, right? And then gradually, tear you down and replace you with someone else. So you go ahead and you manage to your heart's content. So that's that's the system we have. Along with that, of course, then you have other military powers. Like many people become disturbed because, in effect, Australia really is just, considered to be sort of a puppet state. It's one of the, how many states does America have? 52, counting Australia, it's 53. So, rulers have very little power. England, we said they have the monarchy. The monarchy has no real influence, and day by day, of course, they lose their influence, especially as each generation of the monarchy becomes more and more degraded. Prabhupada said that because of the offences that the British government caused in India, in pillaging the wealth of the deities in India, that ultimately the British Empire, basically that was the beginning of the end for the British Empire, the offences that they caused there in India. They had that, at one stage, of course, they ruled so much of the world. Now, they can barely feed themselves. So here, Maharaj Bhrigat, he had sovereignty over the whole world. Very, even to have sovereignty over anything at all these days is very rare. To have sovereignty over the whole world, just imagine how exceptionally unique that is. And it describes here that he performed various sacrifices. So we heard that after the Battle of Kurukshetra, Maharaj Yudhisthira, of course, previously he had performed, the Ashvamedha Yagya or Rajasuya, just before the Battle of Kurukshetra, is that right? Rajasuya. Yes. There was the Rajasuya Yagya, which I think he performed maybe one or three. And of course, that was one of the catalytic events that made Duryodhana even more and more envious than what he already was. It's just, when he went there, he was just seeing just massive, wealth and opulence, and Yudhisthira Maharaj being glorified, it just drove Duryodhana to madness because of his envy. And then after the battle of Kurukshetra, in order to free himself from sinful activities, what he thought were sinful activities, to purify the whole world after such a catastrophic battle, he performed the is that the ashramayana? After Rajasui, that was before. Rajasui
was before.
That's mentioned in the Krishna book. What do they call the horse sacrifice?
Ashwamedha.
Yeah, that's a horse sacrifice. Because then they had to send the horses all around the world, and because they'd been established as the emperor, and that means that anyone who opposes their rule, wherever that horse roams all over the world, and they challenge. You can't let your horse run in my country. And then there's a challenge and there's a fight. And that's the Ashwamedha. Which again is, very, very, very rare. I think it mentions in this chapter, around about verses 12 or so, Pandas quickly flicking through the book, that at about that time that Maharaj Yudhisthira was going to perform the Ashwamedha Yajna, that was about the time that Parikshit Maharaj took birth. Maharaj Yudhisthira ruled for 36 years in total, after the battle of Kurukshetra, from the time of his rule, he ruled for 36 years. And in that time, Parikshit Maharaj was, trained and, put someone under your wing.
Groomed,
sort of, yeah, for to be the future king of the world. And then after the Pandavas had all gone back to Godhead, gone back to the spiritual world, that Parikshit Maharaj, he was ruling from Hastinapur, Indraprastha, and Vajra, who is the grandson of Krishna. So Parikshit Maharaj was the grandson of Arjuna, the son of Uttara and Abhimanyu, and Vajra was the son of Krishna, and he was ruling under Parikshit Maharaj from Mathura. So Parikshit Maharaj went to Mathura to visit Vajra and the queens, because the queens, when Krishna had told Arjuna that he should go and take the queens from Dwarka and take them to, Vrindavan, and I think on his way first to Indraprastha, the robbers attacked Arjuna. That those robbers were somehow, Krishna himself organized to steal some of his own queens, but. As far as I understand, some of the queens went back to the spiritual world at that stage, but others went to Braja. And they were still there, even after the Pandavas had gone back to Godhead. And Parikshit Maharaj went there, and he was speaking with Vajra. And Vajra was saying to him that, I've been deputed to rule over Mathura, but it seems like an empty forest. There's no one residing here. And he said to Prigga Maharaj, you know, where is everyone? So, and so Prigga Maharaj sent for Sandilya Muni, who was one of the priests for the Nanda Maharaj. And he came and spoke to Prigga Maharaj, and he said to him that, you know, apart from the queens, of course, and others, but he said that this land of Vrindavan is the spiritual abode of Lord Sri Krishna. And when he comes to this world, he performs pastimes in Vrindavan in order to display a sample of you know, the wonderful relationships that the devotees you know, are privileged to in the spiritual world with Lord Sri Krishna, to attract the conditioned souls back to Vrindavan, Goloka Vrindavan, the spiritual world. And he said when Krishna appears, three types of devotees associate with him. There are the nitya siddhas, and those, many of those nitya siddhas went back to the spiritual world with Krishna. There are the sadhana siddhas, or those who were great devotees from many, many lifetimes, and by associating with the nitya siddhas, they also get to go back to the spiritual world. And then there are the demigods, that many of the demigods, you know, some of them after Krishna goes back to the spiritual world, some of them actually go back to the heavenly planets. So they're certainly purified, but they may not necessarily be qualified at that stage, you know, at that point to go back to the spiritual world. And so he explained that, you know, they've either gone back to the heavenly planets or they've gone back to the spiritual world. Although, in actuality, you know, if you, by Krishna's grace, if you develop a spiritual vision, you can see that this Vrindavan is not different from the spiritual world. In essence, you can actually see their pastimes going on in an unmanifested way. They were feeling somewhat separation, and the queens also were also feeling separation from Krishna and the other nitya siddha devotees. And one of the queens, Rahini, who was, you know, one of the head of the 16,000 queens, she was speaking with Kalindi, and Kalindi was explaining that previously, when the gopis were feeling separation from Krishna, just as you are, Krishna sent Uddhava. And when Krishna sent Uddhava, Uddhava was able to, you know, relieve their feelings of separation. So she told them that actually Krishna sent Uddhava to Badarika Ashram, but he also resides here in the form of a creeper. But if you have a big festival and kirtan and everything, then Uddhava, well, he may come, you may attract him, and he show you how to relieve the pains of separation. And so they had that big festival in Vrindavan, and Uddhava did appear. And Uddhava appearing, he explained about the nature of Krishna and Krishna's pastimes. Particularly he explained about the Srimad Bhagavatam, that when Krishna leaves this planet in the Kali Yuga, he remains in the form of Srimad Bhagavatam. And by, you know, being absorbed in the Srimad Bhagavatam and the pastimes of Krishna, Krishna becomes personally present. So All those devotees, they actually became absorbed in the various pastimes from the Srimad Bhagavatam of Lord Sri Krishna, and then actually Krishna became manifest before them, and they became absorbed in ecstatic love for Krishna, and they all went back to Godhead. So, of course, Prithvi Maharaj perceived this, and Bhadra, you know, he asked that you please recite the entire Srimad Bhagavatam to us. And so Uddhava said, yes, yes, I will recite Srimad Bhagavatam. And Uddhava said to Prithvi Maharaj, but you have to go because the age of Kali has entered. And because the age of Kali has entered, you will have to go and defeat Kali personified and protect the people and rule the world. So Prithvi Maharaj was quite disheartened. He was very saddened that he would not be able to hear Srimad Bhagavatam. And so Uddhava said to him that, you know, don't be concerned, because after some time, the great devotee Sukadeva Goswami, he will come and he will speak to you, the Srimad Bhagavatam, and you will also go back to the spiritual world like this. So therefore, you know, we know that when Prithvi Maharaj was cursed to die within 7 days by the snake bird, he was not concerned at all, and he did not try to retaliate, because he knew that the arrangement was being made that the Srimad Bhagavatam would be spoken by Sukadeva Goswami for, you know, the benefit of not only himself going back to Godhead, but everyone in the future also going back to the spiritual world. You know, that's a little background information as to, you know, where this section of the Srimad Bhagavatam. A lot of that information there comes from, you know, Srimad Bhagavatam, Hatnyam, and, you know, from the Puranas and what have you. So, here, it's actually describing that news reached the celestial planets about Yudhisthira's worldly possessions. So, of course, for those who have faith in the Srimad Bhagavatam, you know, we'll quite often read the statements like this and then just quickly go to the next verse, and, you know, like that. But for others, for the majority of people, as soon as, you know, you get this statement here, news reached the celestial planets about Maharaj Yudhisthira, they'll think, well, hang on, you know, there's no one living, you know, anywhere else within the universe. You know, the scientists know that. They've been to the moon, and they're coming to Mars and what have you. So, immediately, you know, they will reject the whole Srimad Bhagavatam, because, you know, that becomes just a great stumbling block. But, you know, we understand, of course there's, you know, life on the celestial planets, because, you know, Krishna said in Bhagavad Gita that he spoke to the sun god. So, you know, for devotees of Krishna, that's true. Well, Krishna spoke to the sun god. You know, why would Krishna speak to a dead stone? So, you know, devotees, you know, there's the proof. Well, Krishna spoke to the sun god, therefore there's life on other planets. But again, you know, our proof becomes another stumbling block. You know, because they don't accept Krishna. They don't accept Krishna. So of course, you know, accepting Krishna means that you also accept Krishna spoke to the sun god, and therefore there's life on other planets, and therefore hear these statements that Yudhisthira Maharaj, you know, his fame reaches the celestial planets is not very difficult. But for the non-devote, for those who don't have faith in Krishna, practically, you know, what to speak of Srimad Bhagavatam, but the Bhagavad Gita and everything is just a huge stumbling block. You know, they just completely baffled it. And you know, therefore, if you know they don't accept Krishna and they don't accept Bhagavad Gita, then you know their essential teachings of the Vedas, and they don't accept any of the Vedic literatures. And if they don't accept the Vedas, they don't accept the Aryan culture or you know the Varnashram Dham. And you know, gradually, because of a lack of faith, they will dismiss everything. But you know, a lot of the evidence it is also there in a very practical way. So you know, for instance, you know, they may say that well, you know, Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, they're unscientific. Now, first of all, if they reject the science of God as something not to investigate at all, then that's unscientific. Right? If you, for instance, you know, previously, like psychology or the study of the mind was considered unscientific. It was considered, you know, oh, you know, these crazy people are studying the mind, you know, and it was considered a unscientific. Now, of course, you know, psychology is considered, you know, one of the sciences, but it didn't always have that because it was just too subtle, too difficult to understand. Prabhupada says that generally the material scientists, materialistic people, if there's something very difficult, they just put it aside. So many of the things in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, the science of the soul, the science of God, these things are too difficult, so let's just put it aside as unscientific. But if we look at the scientific evidence, so for instance, the ancient, those so-called primitive persons from ancient India, who were very unscientific and you know, very you know, barbaric and running around intoxicated on Soma Ras, somehow or another those foolish people running around the forest had mathematically calculated the exact movements of all the celestial spheres in the universe. And you know, so, for instance, you know, in the study, I study Vedic you know, astrology, and every single type of movement the planets make has been mathematically calculated, and not only calculated but studied. So those, you know, ancient primitive people, they could tell you, you know, how many stars in each of the constellations, even though they didn't have telescopes, what have you. But they could tell you that, you know, the constellation, you know, the star, you know, the star group of Kritika or Rahini or, you know, Satavish, it has 7, it has 5, it has 13, it has 50. And if you, you know, check with modern science and their, you know, use of telescopes and what have you, You'll see it exactly confirmed. And they will tell you that, you know, the moon has, moves in this exact time period, which is slightly shorter than the sun's, period. That actually astronomers, we read, I think, in the third canto that there are five different types of years. So generally, I think that, you know, modern astronomers understand it's the solar year and the lunar year. But there are other different types of year, like the year of Jupiter, that is also a sambatsa or a type of year. And every type of, comparison between one celestial movement, its timing, and another, and has also been compared. So, for instance, we just celebrated Purushottam Adhika Mas. Now, you may question. So, now Purushottam Adhika Mas has been, in the Hindu calendar, as far back as many thousands of years you can go back, it's there. Now, when does it fit in? It fits in that in every lunar month, right, which means between from the full moon, then we have Pratipata the first day, then we go to the full moon, and that's 1 month. As one lunar month, from Pratipat, the first day after the full moon, to the full moon. In every lunar month, the Chandramasa, there is one Sankranti, which means one time the sun will change signs. Right? If the sun changes signs twice in a lunar month, then in essence, 1 month is missing. And therefore they add the extra lunar month. But this happens about every 2.5 years. Similarly, so astrologically, when there's a month that doesn't happen, in other words, a part of a month, because there were two Sankrantis in 1 month, and that part month is inauspicious. Generally, if you have major auspicious projects, you may not do them. Similarly, these primitive people, ancient India, they also notice that when Jupiter transits the sign, which means 1/30-degree division of the zodiac, it spends about 1 year in that sign. Now, so, for instance, if Jupiter goes into Aries, and it may then go into Taurus, but then it becomes retrograde, and then it goes back into Aries, and so if you add up the two periods it was in Aries, you say, oh, there's a full year.
Sorry, what's that?
Jupiter spends one full year in every sign. Sometimes Jupiter might spend 6 months in the sign and then it goes into the next sign. But then it goes retrograde and spends another 6 months in the sign before it goes back out. So still a 4 year has been done in one sign. Whenever Jupiter spends less than 12 months, which means 11 months, that year is also considered a year that didn't happen and it's inauspicious.
What's
that?
Did you say inauspicious?
I think the next one's around about 2015. So anyway, practically every movement of all the celestial spheres, even ones that are considered to be somewhat invisible, Rahu, Ketu, there are many subplanets. They're all mathematically calculated when they will come, where they are at that. how fast they move, when they slow down, the relationship between each other. All of these things are mathematically calculated, without fail, everything. And practically, if you're an astronomer, or if you're into astronomy and you study the movements, you'll see that all of that information is there in the Vedic literatures. But somehow or another, and some of that information, you can understand that a huge proportion of that information could only be understood not from the position of Earth. You actually have to have, someone out there on the other planets, who have knowledge. So, there's some, for instance, we're sitting here in this room. We have, a fair idea of most things that are going on in the temple, what have you. There are some things we can't see. We'd actually have to be in a different position to be able to really properly understand. So similarly, if you actually take the astronomical science to properly understand it, you can't understand everything from the position of the Earth. Which proves that, ultimately, the Vedic science of astronomy was based upon the principle that there is life on other planets, because you actually have to have the vantage point of being on the other planets in order to mathematically and understand the way the universe works as it does. It's practically impossible just to do it from a vantage point. So even that in itself, there are proofs. There are many. So we just accept. Well, Krishna says he spoke. Bhagavad Gita, the Son of God, so we just, and here we read the Srimad Bhagavatam, Yudhisthira Maharaj reached the celestial planets, so we accept that. But there is so much other proof. But the scientists who are actually non-scientific in their approach, non-scientific means they don't even want to investigate. That's non-scientific, Just like previously, they didn't want to investigate the science of psychology. They don't want to investigate the science of the soul. They don't want to investigate the science of God. They don't want to investigate the Vedic science of astrology and astronomy. And there are so many different things. That's a completely non-scientific, let's just put aside. It's just too difficult. So that's, the scientists are therefore non-scientific in their approach. And usually, something is only dismissed if after so much experiment and research, they understand. Just like previously, they spent so many millions of dollars in Victoria to see whether we have any wild cats running around in Victoria, and after 2 weeks and a lot of money down the drain, they decided no, there's no lions and tigers running around in Victoria. Thank you very much. You're out of tax. So, they will investigate these sort of things, but the science of the soul and these things, they'll say, without any research, they say no. So some of us say to them, there's lions and tigers, and panthers running around Victoria. Now any sane person will say, well, I don't think so. It's probably just a big feral cat. So, you wouldn't really investigate. But no, let's throw a couple of $1 million at that one and we'll investigate. And someone says to them, there's a spirit soul, within the body. Oh no, that's ridiculous, We've got no time for that sort of jibber jabber. So, this is their scientific approach. But anyway, we accept we understand also that by following in the footsteps of great devotees like Maharaj Yudhisthira and Brigitte Maharaj that, you know, we become qualified to go back to the spiritual world. You know, or worst case scenario, you end up in the heaven of hell. Anyway, I'll leave it there if anyone has any questions or comments.
When Yudhishthira Maharaj was doing the sacrifice,
yes.
People from higher planets, other planets also came.
Yes.
And also the fact that Srimad Bhagavatam is the highest. So even on the other planets, there are devotees living there, upper planets, if you say.
Yeah.
So is that the scripture what they have there, or is there any other scripture they follow?
Yeah, the Srimad Bhagavatam is available because, you know, Narada Muni goes there. But, you know, the difficulty with, you know, living on the heavenly planets is that they may not be, you know, as interested as they should be in taking advantage of the Srimad Bhagavatam. But yes, you know, these literatures are there. You know, we hear that, for instance, in the chapter 86, I think, of the Srimad Bhagavatam, where the Vedas personified, you know, as a Brigitte Maharaj asked Sukadeva Goswami, you know, is it possible that with our mind and senses we can actually come to the transcendental platform? You know, in essence, is, you know, if our mind is fixed upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is he actually spiritual, and therefore we do become spiritualized? So this question he asked, and then Sukadeva Goswami referred him to a conversation that was had by Naranarayana Rishi, who referred to a conversation that was had, was it by the Kamaras? So these, you know, those chapters of the Srimad Bhagavatam, there's quite a few chapters, you know, that was spoken, you know, in many various different places throughout the universe. So, you know, this knowledge is there in throughout the universe and discussed. But, you know, the difficulty of living in the heavenly planets is that, you know, one may not be particularly interested enough in going back to the spiritual world. And you know, there's a tendency to want to enjoy the facilities. But, you know, therefore it's described that those who are, you know, if they do hear the Srimad Bhagavatam and they do become, you know, serious, then they actually desire sometimes to take birth on this earth and join in the Sankirtan movement, because it's actually a more conducive situation for them to then, you know, surrender completely to the teachings of the Srimad Bhagavatam and engage in the Sankirtan movement and go back to Godhead. So, you know, just like sometimes we've had devotees, some of the Indian congregation, they go back to India and then they come back to Melbourne and they think, oh, you know, Melbourne's a better place for, you know, even though India is a Punjabun, is that what they call it? Land of piety. It's a land of piety. And yet sometimes they come back to Melbourne thinking, well, this is more conducive. And Srimad Bhagavatam is there also. And sometimes they come back to Melbourne and think, well, this is more conducive. They have Melbourne Temple to take advantage of the Sankirtan. So it's like that, you know, you go to the heavenly planets because of, you know, the piety that's there, but it's actually more conducive to come to Melbourne Temple. And, Saint Kitavan. So therefore, you know, we have to appreciate that, had to be careful who we're talking to out in the courtyard. You know, some of the children and the devotees who have taken birth, maybe some of the demigods and the different devotees who want to, you know, take advantage of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And therefore, of course, you know, we should also understand the importance of, you know, hearing and chanting the Srimad Bhagavatam. That, you know, if we get the opportunity to speak the Srimad Bhagavatam to the devotees, you know, we should understand it's an extremely important event. You know, and I have noticed that that's one thing where I've found that ISKCON has improved immensely over the years. That, you know, previously I noticed that, you know, if you were a Prabhupada disciple, mostly you got to speak Bhagavatam. It wouldn't matter whether you actually understood it or not. That was really that was, you know, your qualification. Or if you had some, you know, significant position, and it didn't really matter what was the quality, you know, in many cases of what they were speaking. You know, I tend to notice that there were, you know, many of the most, say, regular speakers would rotate three or four classes, you know. So they had three or four classes and they just rotate those. But, the quality of devotees in ISKCON, you know, understanding the importance of speaking Srimad Bhagavatam, generally there, you know, that is one thing that has increased quite significantly. Devotees, you know, studying the scriptures properly and, you know, trying to, you know, understand that, you know, here is a, you know, an immense, you know, important, you know, event. You know, when we hear Srimad Bhagavatam, when we speak Srimad Bhagavatam, we should consider like that. That, you know, it is an extremely significant event. Discussing things, you know, about Maharaj Bhrukit and Yudhishthira Maharaj and Lord Sri Krishna and his queens and like that. Any other questions?
Yeah. It looks like most of the things are happening on planet Earth only. Like we see, all the great sages are born here, Srimad Bhagavatam is recited here, Battle of Kurukshetra took here. So it looks like it's a staging area, like a stage where people perform what we.
Yes, the Earth planet is particularly important for, as far as, you know, perfecting the human form of life and you know, becoming perfect and going back to Godhead. Because, you know, generally in the heavenly planets, although the opportunity is there, the nature of the enjoyment is extremely bewildering, more so than here. In the hellish planets, you know, the materialism and therefore the suffering is, you know, just such that it makes it is not as conducive. The balance on the Earth planet is, you know, in between. You know, there is sufficient, you know, enjoyment and, you know, suffering without being so extreme. But we see, even on the planet Earth, in some parts of the world, some countries, you know, where they're suffering, you know, extremely, it's very difficult to, you know, to approach people about this subject matter. They're just absorbed in the suffering too much. And then other parts of the world where they're just so much in need. So generally the Earth planet, but we get a sample, you know, because everything must be here. So, you know, generally those who take birth, those who are in the mode of passion generally take birth on the earth. If you're predominantly in the mode of passion, you take birth on the earth. But we also have so many animal species of life and plants who are, you know, significantly in the mode of ignorance. But if they weren't here, how would we exist? But it's that middle platform.
Most of the devotees also, almost all of the devotees have taken that thing, although it's called the planet of misery, mortal planet. You see Kunti Devi or Pandavas, all the great devotees of the Lord have taken that thing.
That's because Krishna comes. Because Krishna, you know, when Krishna comes to the universe, he comes to the earth planet, Jambadvipa. And therefore, all the greatest devotees, they come from those places as well. That's why.
I think it was a very inspiring class. I was just wondering, what happened to the sons of Krishna in the battle of Kurukshetra? It's nowhere mentioned that you know in Yoga Kruka and others. What they were playing there?
The sons of Krishna?
Yeah.
After the Battle of Kurukshetra, they were part of the, you know, destruction at Bhadarikeshram, where you know the many of the Yadavas destroyed each other. Krishna arranged that to take them back to Godhead.
And is it normal what happened to them during the Battle of Kurukshetra? Because it's never mentioned that they actually were part of the battle. What happened to them? They were in fire all the time? Or?
Yeah, I haven't heard that they took part in the battlefield. It would be quite significant. You know, you'd get a mention in the book if they did. You know, as far as I understand, they were in Dwarka with, you know, all the residents of Dwarka. But after the Battle of Kurukshetra, then Krishna also, just before he departed, he also removed all of those personalities. All right, thank you. Hare Krishna.
Thank you.